Before I get into the discussion of deadlock and such, there are two or three classic problems that people talk about when they talk about concurrency. Problems in the sense of sort of amusing stories about how concurrency might be used to illustrate something. And one is called the producer-consumer problem, and this is the one that we started to talk about last time, where you have sort of things coming in to a single channel from multiple sources, possibly, and things going out of that channel from multiple sources. And there's a variation of this, which is to say, suppose I say the channel cannot buffer an arbitrary number of messages. Suppose I fix the length of the channel. So it can have only 5 messages in it, or 4, or some number. Pick a number. So there is the original problem that I started to describe was called the producer-consumer problem. The bounded version is not surprisingly known as the bounded producer-consumer version. And the point of working through them is to show that with semaphores, you can actually get all these problems to work outright. And tomorrow I'm gonna bring a laptop in so that I can sort of go through the animations and we'll look at all these problems in sequence. But the other one that I am morally obliged to talk about out of some misguided respect for tradition is called the dining philosopher's problem. This is misnamed because philosophers rarely dine in practice, they starve. So it's actually the starving philosopher's problem, especially since, in fact, the problem is that the philosophers aren't getting fed. And here's the problem. It says, okay, I got a table, and I'm going to sit 5 philosophers at this table. So we already know the conversation is going to be dicey. But so I'm going to have these 5 philosophers at the table. I also wonder why it is that we pick on philosophers. Why isn't 5 starving computer scientists? But nobody would believe that computer scientists would starve until recently. So, Now the funny part is, the person on the Hopkins faculty who I think I feel closest to is in the philosophy department. So, so we also have 5 chopsticks on the table. Don't ask me how we get 5 chopsticks for 5 people. You know, obviously they didn't tip the waiter very much. So the question is, how do we arrange for the philosophers to eat? What order? Is there some order that they should pick the chopsticks up in such a way that they'll get to eat? And the first thing you try is say, okay, good, everybody starts by picking up the chopstick to their left. Fine, there are no more chopsticks on the table. And now they'll pick up the chopstick on their right, which is gone, right? And nobody eats. The second thing you try is, essentially you start a counter going around the table. And you arrange it so that, you arrange it so that you're going to use semaphores so that each philosopher is going to wait for both of the chopsticks they need, pick them up, eat, and then put them both down. But the problem, there are a couple of problems with this. So the first thing is, and the idea is this is a metaphor where the philosophers are supposed to be processes and the chopsticks are supposed to be critical resources. Let's not play with that. The first thing to notice is there are a variety of ways that you can get into trouble. So one is, as long as I grab both chopsticks, I'm going to get to eat, and somebody else is going to lose out. Fine. Okay? But you're in a bit of a race because everybody's going to wait for one chopstick, and then everybody's going to wait for the other chopstick. And now they're waiting on 2 conditions that may never actually be simultaneously satisfied. And so you can get into deadlock situations. And the solution is to say, what I'll do, really, I need something else I can wait on that will guarantee that my attempts to get the chopsticks are properly serialized. So the solution is to say, well, actually, I'll treat the whole table as a resource. And what I'll do is first I'll wait on the whole table. So I'll grab a global semaphore. This is the, I'm about to try to pick up some chopsticks semaphore. Right? So now I've got the right to mess with the chopsticks, and at least for the moment, nobody else does. Now I'll go and I'll try to grab two chopsticks, and I'll either succeed or I'll fail. The rule is, I have to grab the two that are next to me. If I succeed, good, I'll eat. If I fail, then I don't get to eat. And the problem is here, I can still get into trouble. If I do these things in the wrong order. But the the upshot of it is that what now will happen is you'll discover dynamically that one of the philosophers gets both chopsticks. And because one guy has two chopsticks, mostly what's going to happen is nobody else is going to get two chopsticks. You know, I mean, think about it. You only got five chopsticks. If the person eating needs two, then at most two people are going to eat because one's going to be left over. What's going to happen with that semaphore design is you're going to get into a situation where one party gets the chopsticks, and then when they put them down, the party next to them gets the one that they're missing. And so what you're going to discover is the eating is going to operate in lockstep around the table. We'll go through that in a worked example tomorrow. I've had a couple of administrative questions. So one, status on accounts for the project. We finally have the machine cleared. I'm going to create accounts hopefully tonight. I believe I have public keys from all of you. Has anybody not sent me a public key? Okay, that was supposed to be in my hands a week ago. Is there a reason I don't have it?
I've been busy.
That's not an excuse. Okay, send me a public key. All right, so I'm going to get those accounts created, and I mean, busy for a week and a half for a 30-second operation is really deeply not impressive, by the way. I'll get those accounts created, and we'll set a deadline for that project. Yeah.
When you generate the key, do you want us to generate RSA or RSA1?
The instructions were DSA.
DSA. Okay.
Right. The other thing people have asked me about is what's going on with the midterm. I will also get an announcement out of midterm date tonight. How many of you are planning to leave early before spring break at this moment? One. Okay, so when are you actually planning to leave?
I'm leaving Tuesday night for spring break.
Okay. That's bad because I was contemplating giving the midterm that Wednesday. And my only other option is to give it after spring break, and everybody hates coming back from break to an exam.
I can take it like Tuesday during the day.
Okay, let's see if we can work that out. I mean, I want to look at the calendar and make sure there's enough time for people to study too, so it may be that I have to do it when I get back, but I'd like to do it before, if time permits. All right. The problem with, there's several problems with concurrency. The first is, I forget to put the necessary guards in the right places, whether I'm using semaphores or monitors or whatever. It's very easy to have a situation where I actually have a shared writable value and, you know, there are lots of things going on and somehow I missed a place that I needed to protect. So this is actually the most common source of errors. The second most common source of errors is some kind of a flow error. So all of the examples you'll see in textbooks are of the form, wait for some semaphore,
let's look at the Donic philosophers one. Which primitive did they use? Right.
You'll see in the textbooks, wait for some semaphore followed by some action, followed by signal some semaphore. Now this is a very, it's a useful first way to illustrate the idea, but it's deceptive in practice, because in practice code is never this simple. What happens in practice is you'll grab some semaphore and this stuff in the middle will call some procedure, which is fine. But then what you'll discover is there's some other piece of your system that also needs to call that procedure. And now the situation is you have a procedure where one of its input assumptions that's not really documented anywhere, or doesn't tend to be documented anywhere, is it assumes that, hey, at the time this procedure is called, you better have already grabbed the right semaphore. The second caller never does. All right, now what happens is you get a bug report, okay? And this is the concurrency bug. So it takes about 15 billion years to figure out which piece of code did the wrong thing. And you conclude that it was this procedure that you called in the middle. Okay, so here's my procedure. Now, you don't realize this procedure is being called from 15 places. What it looks like is this procedure manipulated a resource without grabbing the necessary lock. So here's your next move. You say, oh, I should fix this procedure. And rather than go touch the 17 places that called it, what I'll do is I'll have it grab the semaphore. You test this, and you discover that your machine now halts quickly. Why? Because you can't grab a semaphore that you already have. That doesn't work so well. So now you say, ah, right, that wasn't the right fix. And now you contemplate two bad solutions. The first one says, what I'll do, I'll modify the lock design so that as a special case, it's okay to grab a lock that I already have. Now it doesn't deadlock. But now I need to counter. So I need to release the lock the same number of times. Otherwise, somewhere I'll have an inconsistency issue. So the next bug you'll discover is you grab the lock three times and you only release it twice. Or you grab the lock three times and you release it four times, which with the counting semaphore gives you a negative count, which is not necessarily what you wanted. All right, that's one bad solution. That, by the way, is a common bad solution. The other bad solution is to say, well, you know, really, the lock may already be grabbed. I'll check. And so you say, ah, well, in this inner procedure, I will only grab the semaphore if it's not already grabbed. Okay, we make sure we grab it if we need it. We don't grab it redundantly. What's wrong with this picture? Why is this a bad idea? Yeah.
You're releasing it twice as you got it on the way, unless grabbed is implemented looking for the semaphore outside.
Actually, this is a famous example of why I should never put code examples on the board. I am famous for several years of teaching the OS course. Every year when I write the factorial function on the board, I get it wrong. And each year I write it wrong in a different way. The guys in my lab have come to refer to this alternatively as shat fact or not fact. I think lately they like not fact. Okay, what's actually wrong with this example? I wrote it completely wrong.
Second conditional should never fire.
The second, the release, the signal is never going to happen. Because if it wasn't grabbed before, I grabbed it now. Whoops. Now, it gets worse, right? So that will be the first fix on the NIAF, right? I must have had the condition inverted. Now what happens?
It releases inside whether it was taken inside or outside.
I'm going to release it whether I grabbed it or not, right? So the outer call grabs it, calls F. F says, oh good, I don't need to grab it again. But then it says, hey, I better release it. And now any code after the call, which is operating under the assumption that the semaphore is still held, has had its assumptions violated.
Sorry, I can't read from here. What's the condition for releasing it?
If not, the condition for grabbing it was if it's not grabbed, and the condition for releasing it is, well, if it is grabbed, release it. Okay. The condition we wanted was if I grabbed it, release it. Okay, well, good. So there's an obvious fix for this, which is to say, what I'll do is I will remember. I'll remember whether I grabbed it or not. Don't remember this in a global variable. Yeah, you're laughing, okay? These are real examples. Every one of these errors has been actually observed in the wild. All of them at various points have been observed in Linux. And not just once, like 400 or 500 times each. And the problem with this discipline is it involves writing extra lines of code. Programmers are lazy. It is studly not to write more lines of code. So you will see people skipping this, okay? And you'll see code that writes things like this. Where A and B are global variables. We're doing the test, right? But the hidden assumption here is A and B are not changing. God help you if those things are mutable and are not themselves properly under semaphore control. In fact, there's a kind of analysis that will help you find these bugs. It's called type state. Okay, so the idea is we have a type, semaphore, and we're going to introduce a little state diagram of what states it's allowed to be in. Okay, and the states are, you know, dumb things like grabbed or not grabbed. Okay, and we're going to do the following check. We're going to say, oh, we observe that what's required for wait is that on the input to the wait it must be not grabbed, and on the output we know that it's grabbed. And the reverse for a signal. And now what we'll do is we'll do lightweight static checking. We'll just check all the paths. And we'll make sure that we'll build a state diagram that says, oh, it should be the case that all semaphores sort of behave in this reasonable way and that at the end nothing's grabbed. And we'll check. Well, except it turns out in order to analyze this case, what you will find if your checker is lightweight is that it considers all paths without regard to conditionals. So whenever it comes to an if, it just assumes that it might go either way. And then, in fact, not only might it go either way, but it will go either way. Sometimes it'll go one way, sometimes it'll go the other way. And the checker is not able to see that these two paths are correlated. Worse. Then somebody says, good. What the checker needs is more intelligence. I will teach it about what's called conditional liveness analysis. Why? Well, this is a conditional. We want to know if this conditional is still live here. And there's a classic piece of work by Rob Strom extending the type state idea, which Straub had come up with in the early 80s, in the early 90s, extending it to deal with conditional lightness analysis. But they're still thinking in terms of lightweight static checking, so you're trying to do this without doing whole program analysis. And guess what? If these things are globals and they're mutable, you don't know if this condition still holds. So a lot of these lightweight checking techniques are conservative. In fact, they're all conservative. And they're all what's known as unsound. Unsound means if you run the tool and it does not report any errors, you have no reason to believe that there are no errors. Right? Unsound means the tool may catch errors, but it is not guaranteed to catch errors. And the reason it's unsound is, well, where do we have these tools? We have them because we're trying to run them on things like kernels. What languages are kernels written in? C. In spite of what you may have heard, C is an untyped language. The C type system has to do with representation. It doesn't have to do with type state. Right? You have pointer casts. You have all sorts of operations that can violate the alleged type system in the language. And so any attempt to analyze a program in C is basically hopeless. That's a little strong, but not terribly strong. So, look, the reason I'm going through these examples is I want to point out that concurrency is a way to go wrong with confidence, even for experts. And the problem is not the simple examples that you see in a textbook. The problem is what happens as the code evolves. I have a friend who is fond of the phrase robust to maintenance. Meaning that the software you have may or may not have the property that over a life cycle of maintenance it continues to be robust. There are idiomatic designs that 5 years from now, when somebody modifies your code, and they don't know what you're doing, they don't have time to look at the whole code base, if you write one way, likely they won't break anything. If you write another way, likely they will. Okay. Actually, her phrase is not robust to maintenance. The context was robust to failure. Right. This is code that with high likelihood will fail as a consequence of maintenance. Right. And part of the reason that we have a lot of code like that is it takes 10 years of experience to learn how to write code that other people don't break, because it takes at least 5 years of experience to learn how not to break code that other people have written. And one of the things you'll discover is you maintain other people's code. Often the right strategy is actually to go back and fix their code to improve its robustness in the face of maintenance, because you know you're going to be in here again someday. And if it's not you, it'll be some other portion. Then you will discover that your management doesn't want you to do this because every change to the code is risky. Right? There's an interesting, people write code and we all write code assuming that when we put it down it's done. No, unfortunately, code has a life of its own and its evolution resembles cancer. Unfortunately. And if you don't believe that, go look at the lines of code measurements for Windows over the years. That's maybe not a metaphor I would have chosen if I'd stopped for a femtosecond to think about it, but it's not a bad metaphor either. All right.
So this the example where you've got the Boolean need grab and it's a local variable that can't be changed by anyone anywhere else. That's a safe way to go?
Well, you hope it can't be changed by anyone anywhere else. In fact, there's nothing in C stopping you from taking the address of something on your stack,
right,
other than your good judgment. You know, which you have and I have, but the rest of the world.
Assuming, you know, something's not going to go and start, you know, searching through the stack to try to change variables that are completely out of scope to them.
You know, like a garbage collector.
It's C. It's no garbage collector.
You don't know that. You never heard of the bone washer collector?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so assuming nobody's playing with your stack. In fact, the purpose for making this variable local was indeed... what you're going to do, it doesn't really matter technically if the variable is local or global, but by making the variable local, you're sort of signaling that you intend that nobody else should mess with it. But the compiler is not your friend here. Let me point out that the compiler can hurt you too. So in particular, suppose there's no procedure call in the middle of this.
So,
in particular, suppose you use the fast in memory lock design. Right, it's the one where you're going to do the compare and swap or the test and set before you call the system lock. Now you want this thing to be fast, right? So your intuition is to say, oh, well, when I implement the fast wait and fast signal operations, I'll inline them. Good. I don't have to do a procedure call. I only have to do a procedure call with slow path. Right? Be very careful. The compiler now is going to say, ah, I noticed that you have these two slow paths. And I noticed that the slow paths are correlated. Because while the lightweight static checker doesn't do this analysis, the compiler has to do this analysis for optimization purposes. It says, ah, you did a fast path test. In the case where the fast path test succeeds, I see that the slow path test will always succeed. So I will inline a bunch of things. And then I will do expression folding. And one of the things that I might do at that point is I may say, ah, if this need grab condition was a simple condition, maybe it's better just, instead of copying it to a local variable and then referencing it from the local variable, I'll just put it in line in all the places where you looked at it. What the compiler doesn't know is that this is concurrent code. And therefore, it does not know that the condition that you computed here, which I wrote as a procedure call, but it might be just a global variable check, it does not know that that condition is checking a variable that could be modified by somebody else. So as a consequence of optimization, well-written checks can get messed up, and there are now compiler additions, features, that are designed to avoid this problem.
Yeah. So C provides volatile.
That's just what I'm talking about right now. So C introduces this thing called volatile, which says every load and store to this variable must be respected as written, and it may not be reordered with respect to other loads and stores. You can't do any optimization that would actually alter the ordering of references around this variable. And you can't eliminate it. How many of you think that you can get the use of volatile write routinely? So the features are there. All right, the point of all of this is you're sailing between two very over-constrained sets of problems, right? On the one hand, you better not miss any semaphores in concurrently accessed data structures. And second, you better get your order of grab and release correct. You better not do the wrong number. And now we're going to get to deadlock next,
right?
And the compiler is not your friend in this process. Now, the reason that this mostly works in practice is that most of the conditions are not simple conditions. And the minute you put a procedure call in here that the compiler is unable to reason across, it makes the conservative assumption that any answer computed before the procedure call that involves global state, it might have changed and therefore it has to be recomputed after the procedure call. And under that assumption, it can't inline the tests. So if you go through the Linux kernel, you will discover there are actually surprisingly few places where the volatile keyword is used. That's a bug. The reason they're getting away with it is that almost all of these pieces of code involve procedure calls. They're getting away with it by accident. And as GCC4 gets better about inter-procedural analysis, some of this code will spontaneously break. Now for the fun part.
Deadlock.
So we have all these locks. We have multiple parties grabbing and releasing them more or less at the same time, or at least trying. There's some interesting collisions we can get into. So deadlock basically is when, so the simplest case is you and I get in a situation, you're waiting for something I've got, I'm waiting for something you've got, each of us turns to the other and says, right? And so neither of us makes any progress. I would never say that to any progress. Now, more generally, that can happen with any number of processes greater than one. What you need is some kind of a circular dependency. And in fact, if you get your releases wrong and you design your semaphores wrong, you can even get a circular dependency with yourself. But that's through a bug, not through a timer. All right, so what does it take to get into a deadlock situation? Well, the first thing is, what are the conditions you have to have for a deadlock to arise? Well, the first thing is, you have to have mutual exclusion. You have to have a situation where only one process can get the resource. The second is you have to have something called hold and wait. So it has to be the case that I can be holding one resource, that is, I have grabbed it, and while holding the first resource, I can be waiting for the second resource. Because if you think about it, if we were to introduce the constraint that nobody can hold more than one resource, that would also guarantee non-deadlock, because I could be waiting for something, and you could be waiting for something, but there's no way either of us could wait for a second something, and if we don't wait for the second something, we can't build the server. The third condition that you need is you need non-preemption. This is a different kind of preemption than we talked about in scheduling. We're talking here about preempting your lock. So in particular, the scenario that they're talking about here is, I hold something, I go to get another thing, I can't get it because somebody else has it. What do? I block. What does it mean, block? It means I give up the opportunity to be scheduled because the resource is not available for me to make progress. Now I'm going to deschedule while holding this other resource. So I can hold this other resource for a really long time. And if he ends up in a cycle waiting for me to release this resource and I'm not even ready, and there's no mechanism in place to recover, we can have a problem. And the recovery mechanism is to say, look, you've been holding that resource an awful long time, and sorry, you're not making any progress. We're going to whack you. And when we whack you, we're going to release the resource. If you don't have a way to do that, you can't recover from the deadlock situation. And the fourth requirement is you have to have actually a dynamically circular dependency. Right? If we can arrange our weights in such a way that they guarantee the impossibility of a cycle, then deadlock becomes impossible. Now,
doesn't that depend on the resources that are
needed? Nope. If there's no cycle, there's no deadlock. Period, full stop.
No, but how you build, to avoid building a cycle, it would depend on what resources each procedure needs.
Yes and no. So the answer in theory is, yeah, it could depend on the resources you need, but in practice it doesn't seem to most of the time. And I'll come to why. Probably, I want to go back to this preemption issue because there's a big lie hiding in preemption. So the story now is you're going to ask in sequence for a series of locks, and at some point you're not going to get one. You're going to be holding a bunch of other locks, and you're going to wait. And therefore, you're going to deschedule. You're going to get preempted in the scheduling sense. And now let's talk about preempting the locks. Suppose I, the operating system, say, yeah, you're just a lizard. You haven't run in a long time. I'm taking your toys away. What do we know about those resources now? Are those resources, when you're holding locks, if I take those locks away, what do I know about the consistency of the resources?
No guarantees what the data looks like inside of them.
No guarantees that the resources are consistent. Because if you held a lock, you were entitled to modify the resource. Now what this reveals is, in situations where you're doing operations across multiple resources, we're going to need a coding discipline. And the coding discipline is, you don't modify anything until you've got all the locks you need. Because otherwise we can't preempt. That's actually a surprisingly hard coding discipline to do. Suppose, on the other hand, we were to successfully impose this discipline. Suppose we said, look, we're going to design the operating system. We're going to design every path in the operating system so that first it has a setup phase. The setup phase goes, get all the resources you need and make sure you have all the necessary permissions, but don't touch anything yet. Then there's going to be a magic line we're going to step over after we've got everything we need. And after this magic line, we're going to go ahead and modify things. But after the magic line, we promise never to block. Why? Well, because we know that during the setup phase, we already have everything that could ever make us block. Suppose we were to design our system that way. And notice that if we're going to tell a story about a preemption of a lock, effectively, we already have to design our system. Is there another option that I could now consider, other than preempting the law? Because, by the way, the assumption in the deadlock literature is if I preempt the lock, I'm going to kill the process. Because I don't know what it's doing anymore. More importantly, it doesn't know what it's doing anymore. But suppose we impose this restriction on our system structure. Is there an alternative to preempting the lock?
Sharing it somehow, because when you grab a lock, you're saying at some point soon, once I have all the other things, I'm going to go ahead and modify. But until I have everything else, I'm not going to modify this one.
All right. Unfortunately, you can't share them. The rule was you couldn't modify anything. But you have to be able to look at things. And the reason you have to be able to look at things is it's often going to be the case, the first object you grab, why are you grabbing it? You're grabbing it because you need it to hold still. Why do you need it to hold still? Because inside it, there's some piece of information, like a pointer to a page, and you're going to look at that pointer to figure out what other page you have to lock. What you're really after is to lock the page, but you want to make sure that by the time you're done, it's still the right page to have modified. So, the problem with sharing, you're imagining, well, I'll grab all the locks, but in some sense, they'll be all provisional until I've got them all, and then I'll really take them and I'll do my operation. The problem is they can't be provisional because there are also read dependencies. So the reason I grab the second lock very often in practice is something in the object associated with the first lock told me that the second object also needed to be locked. And if we take this as provisional, then the next guy manages to grab them all, and he does something. He modifies the first thing I looked at, and now I have this whole chain of control flow that relies on the decision that's retroactively no good. So that won't work. What else can we do? We've spent 3 years, by the way, teaching you not to think in this direction, so I won't be surprised if nobody spots it. Yeah. You had a thought? No? Okay. Hey, suppose we just abandon the computation. We just give up. We throw. So the design is proposal. We're going to grab all these locks. We're going to hit one we can't get. When we can't get it, we're going to throw. All the way back to the start of the system call. This is okay, because the rule was we're not allowed to modify anything until we get all the resources we need. One catch, when we throw, we do have to release the locks on the way back. But the effect of this is to guarantee that we are never in a hold and wait situation. At any time where we would wait, we're going to release the holds. Now, what would lead you to prefer or to avoid this style of solution? By the way, there are kernels that really do work this way. They don't actually do it with throw, but the logic of what I'm describing is very much what they do. What would lead you to prefer or avoid that solution?
I think you might want to avoid it for two reasons. One, it seems like you're doing extra work. Instead of holding and waiting, you're, you know, trying to retrace your steps again and again and again. Until, which is the second one to avoid it, you're hoping you get all the locks you want.
Okay, so the first is, let me just restate this. You're right on both counts. The first is, hey, I've got some amount of sunk cost of grabbing all these damn locks. I'm going to have to do the work again. And depending on the likelihood of throwing, look, if the likelihood is 0.00001%, the answer is, who cares? And if the likelihood is 15%, the answer is, you know, I don't like throwing work away. Now, what was your second point?
That you're betting that eventually you'll get all the locks you need when you need them.
The second issue is progress. If I'm constantly backing out and giving up locks and restarting them, backing out and giving up locks and restarting them, backing out and giving up locks and restarting, I may never finish the operation. It is in principle possible to implement a design that guarantees that I will. Yeah.
What if you could have a list on a 7-4, you could have a list of functions to call when the 7-4 was freed up, for example, and you had some function calls. This way, when the locks were freed up, your code would immediately execute.
Well, the problem is, I grabbed four locks, I failed on the fifth one, I backed up, but now I fail on the third one. I back up, now I fail on the fourth one. Back up, now I fail on the fifth one again. There are other people grabbing locks in the middle of all this. However, there's a reason that in fact I will make progress, which is that what we've really done here is we've made all operations in this system atomic. And at some point when you notice, hey, somebody's not making progress, you simply pause everybody else long enough to let them go all the way through. And because the operations are atomic, you know that at the end of the operation, all the locks get released also. So it turns out that, yes, the second one, by the way, is not a trivial thing to design your way out of. It can be done. The real reason to avoid the throw design is if you have a very large sunk cost. And why, what are the issues? So one, what's the likelihood that you will lose trying to get a lock? Two, how many locks do you have to get? These two things multiply, right? And they multiply the wrong way. And three, how expensive was it to figure out which locks you needed? If you have to do a deep traversal of some data structure in order to figure out some lock you've got to grab, you're going to pay for that traversal again. So this atomic style of design turns out not to work very well for monolithic kernels. So it's actually not viable in a system like Unix or Windows because the paths through the kernel are just too long. It is generally viable in microkernels, although there are only three that I know of that do it. One is Eros, the second is QNX, and I believe VX works at least used to work this way. Don't hold me the last one. It's actually almost universal among low-level control systems that they're interrupt-driven and it's very natural for them to work this way. But it does require an entirely different idiom of coding to support it. Okay. And much of... So what can you do about deadlocks? Well, the first is several possible answers, right? One, you can prevent them. You can notice just before a deadlock would occur and say, no, that operation fails. It turns out that's expensive. Because in order to do it, you have to maintain dynamically a dependency graph. And that dependency graph is expensive to maintain for real and difficult to maintain conservatively. Second option. Oh, excuse me, I've just got them mislabeled. So prevention is, find a way to engineer your way out of one of those four conditions. Just make deadlock impossible by design. And that's the approach the Eros kernel took. It took this atomic design option in order to make deadlock at that layer of the system not possible. Avoidance is, notice when it's about to happen, fail that operation. Right, it's a dynamic strategy. Detection is, hey, be optimistic. You know what? Most of the time, it's going to be okay. We're not going to get caught. And once in a blue moon, somebody will get caught and they'll just park. And periodically, we'll run through the system, we'll find the parties who are deadlocked, and we'll kill them. And the likelihood of this happening is so low that we don't care. And in practice, it will often turn out that there's some very short list of unusual resources, and that everything else in practice you won't deadlock on. For example, if you need a page and I need a page, we don't need the same page. That's not the lock condition. We need some page. So we have a very ephemeral lock on the page allocator, but that lock is always held, do the thing, release immediately, and there's never anything else that we grab after that lock. So a lot of locks are like that, and those never get us in trouble. The ones that are going to get us in trouble are things where there's some resource, we need the actual resource, and no other substitute will do, and you need one and I need the other, and actually we both need them both, and one of us gets one and one of us gets the other. The thing is, if you think about it, those resources physically are quite exceptional. Your keyboard is one of those, right? Somebody really has to own it. Your display is also one of those, but your display can be multiplexed. Somebody has to own it for multiplexing purposes, but then it can be virtualized. So it turns out these cases are pretty rare. And the last case is, hey, you can just ignore the problem. And if you think the likelihood of this happening is low enough, that might be okay. Let's be a little pernicious about this, right? Suppose, speaking hypothetically, somewhere in Windows, there was a condition in which a deadlock might arise. What's the longest time that that deadlock might be in effect? He knows where I'm going because he's heard this story before. What's the longest time that deadlock could be in effect? Could it be for a year? Okay, anybody want to go for a month? Why not?
Once you shut off the machine.
Who said anything about shutting off? I'm not, okay, good. I don't get to pull the plug. You're going in the right direction. But there's a cynical point I'm trying to make here, so I'm not going to have fun with that. How many of you have ever actually observed a Windows machine up for as much as a month? I don't believe you. Let me be careful. I have observed Windows machines that are basically idle, that remain up for a month. I've never observed a Windows machine under real production load that stays running that long. I'm sure there's one somewhere. Have you ever observed one that's actually under real load stand for a month? So where? I'm curious.
One of my roommates has only the 3-month trial of Windows. And if he restarts his computer, he will have to wipe his...
Yeah, but what's he doing on?
Web browsing, word process.
Okay, good. That's not under load. And the reason I say that's not under load, the thing about word processors, you exit them. And they may leak resources, but exit is the ultimate recovery of resource. Right. Whereas when you're running a database nonstop for a month at a time, leaks really matter. Right? Things like that. A lot of the reason that our operating systems are survivable in spite of their flaws is that our patterns of usage are in some sense very friendly to recovery as for end user systems. Right? For server systems, it's often not true.
All right. Good. So I'm out of time. So next time I'll talk about resource graphs. But I just wanted to try the problem with the way these slides go, for those of you who looked at the handouts, and I do encourage you to look at the handouts, is they talk about the algorithms, right? And they talk about strategies and they talk about alternatives, but they don't actually get to, so what would make you pick one or the other? And what's the environmental problem you're actually trying to deal with? And one of the reasons I want to go through the animation tomorrow, let me close at this point, it's not just that you have to grab all the locks.
It's that you have to grab them and release them in the right order. Because, and specifically, the preferred technique, you grab them in order of resources. So you grab all the pages you need, and you grab all the whatevers you need, and all the third things that you need. But if you grab the pages first, and then you grab the terminal, you do not then go back and grab another page. That could leave the devil, and we'll see again. But then, when the time comes to release them, you release them in the reverse of the order that you grab them. This is called, it's a stack discipline for grabbing locks. It's a technique. It's not a hard requirement. You can design systems in which other strategies might work. This strategy has the property that it's known not to lead to deadlock as a result of grab order, which is another way that you can deadlock. And the problem with it is it's actually quite hard to do right. And now imagine trying to preserve this discipline across a 2.5 million line system, like the core of the Linux system. You can see that this is a very over-constrained problem. All right, we'll come back to this tomorrow.